For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, what makes a man? Let's consider this verse, first of all. 1 Corinthians 16:13. Be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. So this is all militaristic language, and this call to act like men isn't men as opposed to women. It's really men as opposed to boys. But still, like, what does this mean? What kind of imagery comes into your mind with something like that? You know, what does it look like to transition from boyhood to manhood? Seems like that distinction has kind of been thrown off, you know, and what does our culture really tell us? We look at these men's magazines. What do they tell us it means to be a man? You know, that we need to look real sexy. We need a good haircut. We need a nice suit. You know, we need to lose some weight. We need a six-pack. We need a max interval circuit workout so that we can get good abs and strong arms and everything like that. But this doesn't really tell us a whole lot. Certainly not hitting on the implications of that verse in 1 Corinthians. Here's a study that we're going to be looking at a lot today. This is Philip Zimbardo and Nikita Colon. Okay, so these are two researchers. Philip Zimbardo is a pretty high-class psychologist. He did the Stanford Prison Experiment, if you've ever heard of that. He's done some pretty extensive research into this area, and he and Nikita Colon have written a couple of books together. Here's what they say from a survey they did. Many males who we have surveyed said they felt most like a man when they were honest about who they were, they confidently made decisions, and actively pursued their dreams. Knowing that they're needed motivates them, and they want respect from their peers, specifically from other men. Again, that respect is based both on who they are and on what they do. Okay, so we can kind of summarize basically what men, this is what men are saying they want, this is what makes them feel like men, this is where they feel motivated. They want confidence and security. They want to be able to pursue their dreams, pursue meaningful things. They want respect, mutual respect for the people around them, and they want to feel like they're needed, like they've got something to contribute to a situation, like they have an important role to fill, okay? But instead of really pursuing these things, what we see is this tendency for men to escape. They are escaping into worlds that promise control, that promise pleasure, that promise that they'll be admired if they accomplish certain skills there. And the real problem today is that some of these worlds that they're escaping into are much more available, they're anonymous, they're much more accessible, they're free, and it turns out that they're a lot more damaging. So it's really important that we understand what prompts this escape so that we can help men weaponize themselves so that instead of escaping, they're actually moving in to act in these different areas rather than escaping. So we can kind of give them some areas here. If you notice the far side there, those are all passive. Those are things that someone ought to give to you, that should just come to you naturally, or that should be clear. These are more passive. Where these other areas are all active. These are things that you'd have to engage with the world around you in order to see fulfilled. So these are all arenas for action that I want to discuss today, where men can be called into from a biblical standpoint. But the problem is, each one has an escape route. Each one has a way to escape. It has some belief there that prompts you to retreat from acting in the way that you should, in the way that the Bible calls you to. So that's what I want to discuss today. So let's talk about leadership first. When we talk about biblical leadership, whoops, what happened? There we go. We talk about biblical leadership, we can look to Mark 10 on what Jesus said. He says, "But it is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." So this is biblical leadership. It's servant leadership. It's getting below other people to build them up. It's getting behind other people to push them forward. But I think a lot of men have this feeling, I can't lead. You know, I don't have what it takes to lead. I don't have the skills that are required. I'm not charismatic enough. But this is all stuff, these are all beliefs that come from leading other people to yourself, not leading other people to God. Biblical leadership is not leading other people to following me. It's leading other people to following God, okay? So that's what prompts this escape. And a lot of this, I think, comes from something called the Great Disappointment. This is what something that sociologists refer to. It's this moment that everybody has to go through, and it affects men in a pretty particular way. Here's Leonard Sachs. He's a psychologist. He's done a number of different research studies on gender, on both boys and girls. We're going to be looking at some of the stuff he has to say on this today. So he says, sometime after the onset of puberty, navigating through adolescence, the teenager is hit with the awareness that something marvelous is not going to happen. So this isn't as pessimistic as it sounds, okay? This is actually a good thing. You start off, you're 12 years old, and you're like, I want to be center fielder for the New York Yankees, you know, or something like that. Some big dream. And then as a couple of years pass, you become a little more mature. You start to develop a less egocentric view of the world. You start to view things more realistically. Okay, I don't have to be center fielder for the Yankees. I'm probably not going to be center fielder for the Yankees. And I don't even know if that means all that much to me anymore. I think there's other things that I value also. So this is a good moment to have, and we all need to go through it. He points out this is the great disappointment. It's really developing a more realistic view on the world around you as a teenager. But, he says, in our culture, that moment is often postponed until young adulthood. So people are really poorly prepared for this moment. They're told that they should be able to do whatever they want. They should be able to pursue their dreams. Good things will happen if they do their best in these areas that make them feel really good. And it's being postponed. So this moment that used to be experienced when people were teenagers is now being held off until people are in their 20s. So you got these people coming out of college, you know, going into their mid-20s who are like, wait a minute. What about all my dreams? What about all the fulfillment I was promised? You know, what am I supposed to do now? And it starts to manifest in this perspective that somebody owes me some validation. Somebody owes me for the dreams of mine that I had that aren't going to get fulfilled. And in men, this seems to be enforcing something that Zimbardo and Colom called the entitlement curse. Okay, the entitlement curse. Let's talk about what this is. So they say some males now feel a sense of total entitlement simply because they exist as males. Many now seek long-term shelter either with mom and dad or within their marriages or relationships with a live-in partner. So Leonard Sachs calls this failure to launch syndrome. And that's in reference to the Matthew McConaughey movie that came a while ago. You guys seen that movie? It's a crappy movie. You know why it's not a good movie? It's not Matthew McConaughey. I mean, have you seen Dallas Buyers Club? You've seen True Detective? McConaughey is not the problem, okay? Sarah Jessica Parker might be the problem, but, you know. I think the real issue is that the filmmakers didn't realize how big of an issue they were actually hitting on. This is a major phenomenon. They go on to say that 1 out of 6 men of prime working age who are not working willingly admit they don't even want a job. So these are guys who are about 30 to 50 years old. A growing percentage of them aren't even working. They don't even want a job. And nearly half said the jobs that are available are beneath them. Yeah, that's not meeting my needs. It's not fulfilling my dreams. These guys are content to just hang around doing their thing. It seems to us that this new sense of male entitlement is different from what it may have been in the past. It's more generalized. It's spreading to more settings and activities that tend to undermine any meaningful social or romantic relationships. So this idea of male entitlement, it used to be, you know, I put food on the table, I put money in the bank account, I just want to kick back and watch the game, or I want to go play golf, you know, I want to just hang back and not have anybody bother me. They're saying now the sense of entitlement is applying to all situations, something more generalized, and it's way more antisocial. So it's spreading. It's this really bizarre phenomenon. And you can see how this is totally at odds with the servant leadership that Jesus describes in Mark chapter 10. So what we're looking at is that there's this huge gap between what men do and what men say that they want. And that gap is all centered in self-centeredness. It really all comes down to this really peculiar form of narcissism, entitlement. That's where all of this is leading to. That's where that belief that I can't lead comes from, because guys can't escape this self-centered paradigm. That's the world that they're retreating into. So what happens? This is what a guy says motivates him. It's what he wants. What happens when they try to pursue these things on the basis of self-centeredness? It doesn't really get them anywhere. They're left craving, you know, feeling this sense of entitlement and like they're owed something. And yet this lifestyle that they say they want, it's somewhat available to them through Christ. This is Ephesians 2:10. For we are God's workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so we could walk in them. God has actually outlined a meaningful way for everybody to live, and that includes all men. But that's not just going to come to them on the basis of self-centeredness. These meaningful works are all going to be serving other people. They're going to be taking risks to love other people, stepping outside of your comfort zone, to be vulnerable and to move into other people's lives and to share your life with them. So this plan that God has for men can't really be investigated if they're all wrapped up in disappointment and entitlement. These things counteract. And I think the mistake is thinking, well, if we can boost their self-esteem, we can make them feel better about themselves, then maybe they'll get out and do something. Then maybe they'll investigate this a little bit more. Turns out that that's kind of a falsehood. You know, I don't think we need to boost their self-esteem. Here's Roy Baumeister. Roy Baumeister did years of research in the area of self-esteem and how it affected people's lives. He's a psychologist. And here's what he said. Self-control is much more powerful and well-supported as a cause of personal success. Despite my years invested in research on self-esteem, I reluctantly advise people to forget about it. He's basically saying there that the development of self-control is way more valuable to a person's life than self-esteem is. That's what he's saying. That's what we should be emphasizing here. And when we emphasize self-control and this pursuit, this active engagement with the world around them, we end up redefining some of these terms. Their confidence and security is going to come from having an identity in Christ. You know, your identity in Christ doesn't change. You start this relationship with God, God sees you as you are in Christ. Nothing causes that to fluctuate or waver. And their pursuit of their dreams is going to come from their pursuing Christ, pursuing these good works prepared for them in advance. And the respect they say they want is not going to develop from trying to bring glory to myself somehow or feeling entitled to something. It's actually going to come from my life bringing glory to the Lord. When people see that my life's been transformed, then that allows for a certain sort of respect. And that I'm invested in other people, I'm a better servant, I'm laying my life down. People are seeing that the Lord has transformed my life. That's where that respect comes from. And in terms of being needed, it's not that they're needed because they're the answer to people's problems, but they're going to feel like they have something to contribute if they actually invest in their relationships with other people. But they're not going to get very far without diligence. This is a really important area, probably the one that's affected the most that we're going to talk about today. Let's talk about diligence. The Bible has a lot to say about diligence. I want to just sum it up basically into this verse for now. Proverbs 12:11. A hard worker has plenty of food, but a person who chases fantasies has no sense. This makes sense, right? You know, it seems pretty obvious. But I think this distinction between hard work, getting what I need, and chasing fantasies, like that logic is kind of breaking down because of these new ways to escape. And the escape here for a lot of men is I need pleasure and control. If I'm going to exert myself, it needs to make me feel good. I need to have control. I need to have a certain amount of predictability over my environment. Then I'll really apply myself. Then I'll exert myself. If I know I've got something to contribute, I know I've got a certain level of control, then I'll really apply myself to a situation. Consider this for a second. You guys ever heard of this game? Call of Duty Black Ops. Came out in 2010. Well, 1 month after its release, it had been collectively played all over the world for 68,000 hours. Oh, I'm sorry, that's wrong. 68,000 years. 68,000 years. I don't know what to call that other than diligence. That is some serious time invested into a task, right? Let's be honest, this is mostly young men. I don't know how many girls are out there codding it with each other. You know, I'm sure there are a few. This is mostly young guys, right? That's a serious amount of time invested. Well, let's consider video games. Not all video game usage is equal. And video games are tricky because there's not necessarily a moral component to them. I guess there could be. But they're kind of morally neutral in a lot of ways, but that doesn't mean that what we're talking about with video games is play that's excessive, something that's habitual and almost addictive, and that's in isolation. Playing video games every now and again with a group of friends is not the same as playing them for hours by yourself. And that's where we really see things having a big impact on people's lives, okay? Here's Zimbardo and Cologne. They say, in video games, they get to experience being the hero and the anti-hero without the conditions or permanence of real life and without risking life or limb. Video games offer virtual rewards at regular intervals, often after a certain level has been reached or a specific skill has been mastered. Okay, so the risk is being diminished and even disappearing altogether. While the reward has become more predictable, it's become more regulated, and it's become more valuable. So the reward is increased and the risk is diminished. That's what's happening with video games, and here's what can result from that. Oh, they point out that this is actually operant conditioning. Operant conditioning is what B.F. Skinner used to get pigeons to hit buttons for food all day long, just condition them to go back to that over and over again. They're arguing that that's the same thing that's happening when guys play hours and hours of video games. Here's Clark and Scott from their book Game Addiction. They say a person who's initially motivated by their own intrinsic reasons for achieving may become dependent on these outside rewards and actually lose their innate internal motivation to achieve things in life. So as the risk goes down, as the reward increases, the environment's predictable, the reward's predictable, and it's tangible, real life starts to become dull and motivation for actual accomplishment in the real world begins to diminish. So basically, it's enforcing this belief that I'll work hard if I have control of my environment and if there's tangible rewards given at regular intervals. That's what video games, that's what these digital worlds begin to enforce when guys flock to them, when they need that sense of control and pleasure. This is the belief that gets reinforced over and over again. Let's talk about porn a little bit too. Pornhub reported that in 2015, there were 3 billion hours of porn watched collectively. That's only one porn site. You know, and again, this is mostly young men. Much higher percentage of young men engaging in porn than there are women. And it's having a very peculiar effect on them. We don't have time to talk about everything related to pornography today and its effects, the fact that it's degrading to women, the fact that it's addictive and has similar effects to different types of drugs. If you want to look into that further, I'd recommend James Rochford's Rational Case Against Pornography, which you can find on his website. He's got a lecture and a paper on it. Really helpful stuff. I just want to mostly talk about today how this is related to diligence, all right? So, again, Zimbardo and Colomb say, watching television and porn requires no commitment and has a zero rate of rejection. It provides instant gratification that can alleviate the fear to some degree. So, again, we see this interplay. Risk is diminished, starts to go away. There's no fear of rejection. That's diminished, it goes away. And the pleasure becomes more instantaneous, and it's increased. They point out here that as a side effect, however, it also reduces the motivation to get the skills needed to attract the girl, creating further distance between a man and his ultimate goal. So this is specifically related to dating. Like, I feel admired when I engage in porn and the pleasure is, skyrockets and there's no risk. But it's also killing the motivation to go out and actually meet a real girl. And this pattern has predictable types of consequences in other areas of life as well. It reminds me of something from my own life. You guys ever heard this song, No Scrubs, by TLC? Song came out a while ago. Came out when I was 14 years old. And I wondered, like, what's a scrub? Well, TLC defines it for us, okay? Scrub is a guy who thinks he's fly, he's a buster, okay? It's a guy who can't get no love from me. He's hanging on the passenger side of his best friend's ride trying to holler at me. That's a scrub, right? That's a scrub. It's a lazy, broke dude, you know, who girls don't want anything to do with. And so there I am, I'm 14 years old, right? I'm realizing I'm not going to be center fielder for the New York Yankees. And I'm experiencing all this crazy hormonal stuff, and things are changing, and suddenly I'm drop-kicked with the possibility that I could become a scrub. What if I become a scrub? You know, what if that happens to me? Apparently that can happen. And I was more motivated than I'd ever been in my life at that point. You know, it was like, oh, I don't want that to happen. But now the interplay seems to be, whatever. If a girl's not interested in me, so what? I can have any girl. I can have her anywhere, anytime I want, for free. There's no risk involved at all. Who needs a real girl? Who needs real life? That's what's happening when guys continually escape into these worlds they feel like they control, and that produce instant pleasure. An instant reward. When does this cycle actually begin? What prompts this for most guys? Well, let's consider this. Since 1980, there's been a 71% increase of boys who dislike school. Okay, so, you can relate to this, man. I hated school from the moment I walked into it, you know, and I wasn't even sure why. I got decent grades, but I hated it. Well, Here's some insight from Zimbardo and Cologne. They say a 5-year-old boy and a 3.5-year-old girl have roughly the same language ability. So there it is. Girls just start out smarter than dudes do. It's an oversimplification. But if a boy is forced to learn before his brain is ready, he is unintentionally conditioned to dislike the task. And those early negative experiences create resistance and resentment for learning in particular and school in general. So as these early elementary classes have become more rigorous, as they become more academically demanding, you know, boys just aren't ready for that. And they're being put into an environment where it's actually difficult for them to engage with the stuff they have to do all day long. They're just, a lot of them just aren't ready for that. Leonard Sachs adds to this. He says, young girls are more likely than young boys are to pay attention to what the grown-ups say, to follow the rules, and to care about what the grown-ups think. Now, we could look at this and say, well, that just sounds like, you know, some kind of gender sort of difference, cultural gender expectations or something like that. It's not necessarily true, because they see trends like this actually across the primate kingdom. They've looked at other species of primate, and young female primates tend to look at what the adult primates are doing and copy that behavior. And the young boys are hanging out, hitting each other, and swinging and climbing on things, which are, those are valuable things too. They're building their strength, right? They're not just doing nothing. They're engaging in different types of activities. So that's across the primate kingdom for the most part. But basically, boys just aren't motivated to please adults necessarily. They much rather please their friends. And they're just not into rules. You know, sitting in a chair all day and having to listen and perform these tasks is really difficult for them cognitively. And it's just not what they're motivated by when they're young. And so early on, boys are learning that what's expected of me is just too difficult. This is too hard. I don't know how to handle things here. It's too difficult. I don't get it. And it starts to prompt this escape into worlds where they feel like they can contribute something of value, where they get rewarded for the things that they're motivated by. And this is prompted for a lot of guys really early on. So when it comes to chasing fantasies and what this means, we can say it's the porn and the video games, and that's true. It is a fantasy world. The digital landscape is primarily a fantasy world. But a bigger part of the fantasy is the belief that God and others should reward me according to the digital rubric. God and others should reward me according to the world that I feel most comfortable with. God and others should give me tangible rewards in the environment I feel like I most control. That's where I feel most comfortable exerting myself. And that's part of the fantasy, that God is going to adapt to that. The things that are rewarding about following God aren't necessarily, you know, tangible and predictable. It's so much more about, you know, growing in relationships and getting a sense of your spiritual life growing and learning how to love people. You know, that's a very different type of rewarding experience. And it's not predictable, and it involves some pain. It involves some risk-taking. And those things, the risks are diminished and the rewards are increased. And this is actually starting to manifest as something called arousal addiction. Okay, so here's a quick description of arousal addiction. The part of your brain where arousal happens is the same place where addiction occurs, the reward circuitry. It's where you experience the motivation to achieve your desires. So when you get into porn, what's happening there is the reward circuitry in your brain is spiking, just boom, like over and over again. And these other parts of your brain are trying to balance that out and be like, dude, we gotta slow down a little bit. But with every novel experience, with every click, there's this brand new just boom, the spike. And that's rewiring the circuitry in your brain and the reward centers of your brain so that real life starts to become really dull. You've seen those videos of the guys who like take those Nerf guns and they rewire them so that it like fires out darts like boom, 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 you know. Suddenly real Nerf guns are boring, you know, and you want that new Nerf gun that can fire a whole lot faster. It's really similar. The circuitry in your brain is actually kind of being rewired to just pump constantly. Bam! One time after another. Similar thing with video games, okay? Bear with me on this. These are some big words. So Leonard Sachs says, the nucleus accumbens operates in balance with another area of the brain, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The nucleus accumbens is responsible for channeling drive and motivation and gives the drive a rewarding character, okay? And then the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex provides a target and a context for the drive. So to put this simply, The nucleus accumbens is the part of you that's just like, yeah, I want to do that. I want to get out there. I want to bench press 150,000 pounds, you know. That's your nucleus accumbens. Now, I want to work out. I want to get strong, you know. I want to get beefy, you know. It's like that sort of drive. And then the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is the balancing part. That's the part that says, well, we got to be safe, you know. We're going to have to go to a gym, probably get a trainer. You know, we could do all that, you know. It's like bouncing out. So your nucleus comes, your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's like, okay, yeah, we can do that, but blah, blah. So it's this really healthy interaction, right? Just this balance between like intense motivation and then an understanding of where to channel that. That's the normal way that this occurs. But with video games engorges the nucleus accumbens with blood while diverting blood away from the balancing area of your brain. So that knuckle down, you know, drive for things is just being spiked all over again. And the balancing area just is like losing it. We're like, it's just no context. He says, so the boys get the reward associated with achieving a great objective, but without any connection to the real world, without any sense of a need to contextualize the story. So with every achievement in a video game, you just that drive center is just being like, yeah, but there's no context. So real life again becomes dull. So this really simple equation of motivation, I want to do this because I know this will happen, and this is the way I get there, just is reduced to this. I want to do X. I want to do this thing. I want to do this thing. I want to do this thing. I don't even know why. Just because it feels good. I don't know. Like, it just makes me feel like I did something. And that's just all it is. And so we see that when they escape into these fantasy worlds, that their desires for these passive cravings get met. But they're only partially met. It's semi-fulfillment. If they were fully met, then there wouldn't be an entitlement curse, right? You know, they only get partially met. And it's these desires, you know, cravings in your brain, like those remain pretty far off. We got to win them out of just mere desires, okay? Here's Jeffrey Schwartz and Rebecca Gladding. They're two leading minds in the area of neuroplasticity and behavioral psychology. And they say craving originates in the brain's drive and reward centers, two regions that are focused on self-preservation and instant gratification. That's what we've been talking about, right? Desire and craving are based on the momentary fluctuating signals generated by your brain. Okay? So, more to the point, any specific desire that is present right now can be overshadowed by another desire that is stronger or that pops up a few moments later. So that's like, okay, I've got this far-off desire that I want to lose like 20 pounds. But there's pizza right there. And I'm hungry, you know? So your brain prioritizes desires based on what it's learned is most helpful to your preservation and is most gratifying to what basically it's assimilated its most pressing needs are. So the point that they're making here is that we need to take desires from being this nebulous thing kind of in the air out there that I kind of want to happen, because we probably hear that from guys like, yeah, I'd like to change. Yeah, I'd like things to be different. Yeah, I don't just want to sit around all day. I'd like to accomplish something. But we have to make that craving more concrete. And the point that they're making here is we have to get beyond craving, beyond just mere desires. And we have to actually help draw out what people value, what they believe, and what's meaningful to them. So they call that, you know, the difference between engaging your brain versus engaging your mind. You know, getting in touch with what you value, what you believe. You know, do you believe that there have been good works prepared for you in advance? Like that sort of thing. What matters to you? What's really meaningful to you? We need to help guys build this kind of category in their lives of what they value, and then set goals in line with those things so that these desires, these far-off desires that I want things to change, I would like things to be different, I would like to get out more, whatever it is, they actually have a concrete way to accomplish that. So it's more about building these value systems, building a, you know, a like a menu of belief, basically, and building concrete goals that are short and long-term that are in line with those things. So that it's not just like the sluggard who craves endlessly and gets nothing. It's someone who's got intention and who's got a clear path to follow to get to what they're saying they value. So it's making concrete goals in line with what they value and not just hitting these cravings that seem inaccessible and are overshadowed by what's more available, what's easier to get. Okay? So they need to be invited to accomplishment in the real world And smaller accomplishments can help build bigger accomplishments. You know, you think about a lot of the younger guys that you interact with, they don't know how to do much. They've never really had anybody teach them anything. And I think sometimes we can be too rigid in our time with them because that time needs to be spiritual. And it does need to be spiritual. But that doesn't mean we can't, you know, break out a little bit and teach them some things. You know, teach a guy how to cook a steak. Teach him how to chop wood, how to build a sustainable fire, you know, if he's camping or something like that. You know, don't overlook what can be done in 30 minutes to help a guy get a sense of real-world achievement. Maybe you've even got some things that you want to learn how to do, like change your oil in your car, you know, or something like that. Bring another dude into that and figure out a way to have these smaller real-world accomplishments so that we can win people out of this world where rewards have to be predictable and tangible. So when we talk about redefining our terms here, redefining kind of the driving things of a guy's life, we realize that the context for this really is relationships. That's where they're going to feel, you know, that their lives are really changing is in the context of relationships, right? And that's where a lot of guys are lacking. They have weak, shallow relationships, and they're not sure what to do about that. Let's discuss relationships, okay? Let's go to 1 Samuel 18. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Okay, what are your first reactions to that? How does that make you feel looking at that? You know, maybe that doesn't sound as cool to you as something like this. You know, this is Clint Eastwood. And him and other actors played characters like this, you know, in the 60s and 70s. These loners, they didn't need anybody. I'm tough. Left to my own devices, I can take care of myself. I'm not a bum. No one's going to make a chump out of me, right? It's this belief that I just don't need anybody. You know, I'm a tough guy. I don't need nobody. Okay? The thing is that I think this is still the belief. I don't need anybody. But guys aren't emulating this image anymore. There's something else at play, okay? Studies have shown that shyness, like social shyness, has increased dramatically over the last 40 years or so. And here's what Zimbardo and Cologne have to say about that. Aside from the steady increase in shyness, what's different today is that shyness among young men is less about a fear of rejection and more about a fundamental social awkwardness, not knowing what to do, when, where, or how. So it used to be like, I want to ask that girl over there to dance with me, but I'm afraid that she'll say no and I'll look stupid. You know, so that's old shyness right there. New shyness is, I don't even know how to talk to that girl over there. I wouldn't even know what to say. I don't even know how to dance. I don't even know where I am. Like it's just like the whole social landscape is just completely unclear. So they go on to say, many of them don't know the language of face contact. It's like, you know, talking to you face to face, making eye contact with you, and having a conversation that just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to guys nowadays. They say the absence of such critical social skills essential to navigating intimate social situations encourages a strategy of retreat, going fail-safe. So we see that what keeps them from really getting in touch with this idea from 1 Samuel 18 here is this failure in the social landscape. They don't know what to do, and they feel like they fail continually, and they want to retreat to areas, again, where they feel like they control them. A lot of times they're refusing intimacy because they feel like that's weird, or maybe it's even been denied to them earlier on in their lives. No one's ever really invited them into any kind of intimate setting at all. And so it's prompting this continual escape into worlds that they control. It's very similar. You see the connection here between diligence and relationships? Let's consider where this starts. Okay, so the average school-aged boy, average boy old enough to go to school, spends about 30 minutes a week in one-on-one conversation with his dad. Now, this stat here is a little bit skewed because this is if dad's at home. You know what America leads the industrialized world in? We lead it in several things, but one of the things we lead it in is fatherlessness. 1 in 3 kids grow up without a dad in the house. And if he is there, apparently this is telling us that dad is pretty unavailable in a lot of ways. He's physically there, but he's not engaging his son. And this is over and against this same boy spends an average of 44 hours a week with some form of technology. So with that kind of huge gap between meaningful interaction and technology, where would they ever find models of close relationships? Where would they ever find someone who would show them what that is? You know, think about it. Do they ever say, I love you in porn? They ever say, you make me feel safe? You know, a video game character, is he ever going to reach out of the screen and pat you on the back and say, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you for trying hard. I want you to do it again. I'm here for you, just in case. Where would they ever see this? I was reading about this one mom. She wrote into a newspaper columnist. She was concerned because her son, who was a young teenager, came to her and said, you know, I've been, he told her that he'd been in porn, you know, habitually. And that the porn he was starting to watch was getting pretty far out. And he was actually beginning to have these sexually violent urges towards girls that he went to school with. And he was concerned. So she wrote to this columnist and asked what she should do. And so they consult this sex expert, you know, to comment on it. And the advice that he gives her is this. Your son's just kinky. He's kinky. Some people are kinky. What you need is to find him some kind of network of other kinky men who can teach him how to get his kinky desires out while not being, you know, socially alienating. There's just nothing out there for guys a lot of the time to get any sort of closure on what it looks like to have a close, meaningful relationship. A lot of them have been just left complete bereft when it comes to meaningful, close relationships. You look at this, you say, this is weird, like knit to the soul of someone else. That seems weird and intrusive. You know, I love him as myself. That seems real soft and weak. I don't know if I want that. It's weird. Because no one has ever shown them what this could be like. And they resist it. They just don't even know that this is an option. If they do have relationships, you know, where they do spend time with other people, they tend to also be kind of shallow. And this is seen in something that's called social intensity syndrome. Now, social intensity syndrome sounds really severe. It's a more recent development in psychological research done by Philip Zimbardo. It's mostly been studied in its most severe forms in war veterans. You know, they come home from war, away from their brothers in arms, and how do they adjust to, you know, normal living with, like, people at home or other people in their lives. But they're seeing that it has kind of a more generalized, softer effect on men, you know, in more everyday situations. So social intensity syndrome is really this preference for intense, exclusive, all-male environments. That's really what it comes down to. And in these environments, your skill set is your value. Whatever skill you're bringing to the table, that determines how valuable you are to the group at large. So if you're on like a rec softball team with your buddies and you're the fast guy, you're fast, and so that's the skill that you bring to the table. You're the fast one, right? And the shared experience is the priority, you know. We're together, we're high-fiving, we're slapping each other on the back, we're having a good time. That high-octane experience is what everybody's going for, but there tends to be boredom and isolation outside of that group. So they feel really excited when they're together in this environment, but they get outside of it, they go back to their wives, or they go back to work, or wherever it is, and they feel like out of place and bored. You know, one phenomenon where this was observed, Pornhub reported that during the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, while the game was going on, there was this significant decrease in traffic. But then right after the game, there was this crazy spike in traffic. Okay, so when they're together and they're having the beers and they're high-fiving each other and maybe they even got money on the game and it's really this exciting social environment, you know, then this craving for, you know, that reward is being exercised. But then as soon as they get out of it, they need to spike it up again with some other thing. So it doesn't really accomplish anything that's all that pro-social or important. So it certainly is missing these qualities. These types of environments are missing these qualities, where you're knit to the soul of someone else. You're just that close, you know, and you love someone as yourself. There's an important bond that's formed there. So I think what we can take out of this is this right here. Shared experience is meaningful. Guys like to get out and do stuff together. You know, that means a lot, and it's fun. You know, you get out and you do some crazy stuff. You light a couple of things on fire. I don't know, like that's meaningful to a lot of guys. But these interactions tend to remain shallow. The experience becomes the priority. And when that's the case, this really just becomes a venue to have your personal desires met. You know, the social interactions are really about fueling this need to just have this burst of energy, this burst of excitement, and then I'm going to go home and just do the same thing on my computer console or whatever. Okay, so what we need to do is introduce new priorities to these shared experiences. The shared experiences are good. There's value in them, but someone leading the way on introducing newer priorities to these experiences is really what's needed. Priorities like this one here. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Now, if you can get a guy, if you can model this and then help a guy understand that this is an important value that he can bring to the table, he can speak into another person's life. Even in the midst of having a really good time together, this is still an option. This happens, you know, as time goes on, as you interact with people more often, that you can actually speak into their lives, that you can sharpen each other. You can have an impact on each other's spiritual lives. Someone leading the way by introducing this priority can have a huge ongoing impact on the way a guy thinks about his relationships. This is Zimbardo and Cologne backing this up. They say young men need more than contacts. They need more than contacts, okay? They need confidants. They need people who will physically be there when they're down in the dumps and who sense their need. It's also important to have others recognizing when young men positively contribute to a situation. So this is really what guys need. They need vigilant people who are going to be like a big brother or a big sister to them, who are going to be able to open the door for them to share what's going on in their lives, and then who are going to encourage them when they see them contributing positively. Okay, when you did that over there, you know, when you said this thing to that guy over there, that was really cool. It's really cool that you said that, right? Part of what's going on here, though, is we need to help them develop healthy emotional lives. That's what's missing. You know, they even say that when in social intensity syndrome, they ask guys, what would it be like if anybody shared their emotional experiences with you? And they'd be like, well, that'd be really weird. You know, that would be distracting, you know, from what was going on. It'd be almost like kind of scary. Like, why are you bringing that up right now? So we need to help guys develop a category for this if we really want to see ongoing depth in their relationships, okay? This is what we hear a lot, right, from a lot of guys. I'm just not very emotional. And I think men have even successfully inserted this into the vernacular of everybody. You hear people all the time, yeah, my husband, he's just not very emotional. My boyfriend, my brother, whoever. That's just not true. We're all emotional. God's emotional. He created us to be emotional, right? I think the real escape here is that I'm not supposed to be emotional. That's the real belief. This is what Zimbardo and Cologne say about this. They say, when a young boy is told crying is for girls, he learns that it's not acceptable for him to express his emotions, so he puts them away. When anyone is told who they are and how they're feeling is wrong, they begin to hold back or try to change their internal experience. So he's not saying there that we should advocate for, you know, young boys to be hysterical all the time, but that when we tell them that it's wrong, you're not supposed, because you're a boy, you're not supposed to do that, that's actually robbing them from processing things in the way that they should. It's not teaching them how to process how they feel or how they respond to situations, okay? So they say when this guy grows up and he gets married, say he's having trouble with his wife because she, his wife, wants him to open up more, and he has no idea what she's talking about because he's never opened up in his life. Most men feel stuck here, you know. They hear their wives say, like, I don't feel like you understand me. I don't feel like you listen. I don't feel like I can talk to you. And guys don't even get that. It's because most guys aren't listening. They're thinking, which wrench can I apply to this situation? You know, which gears need tightened up here in the proper way? You know, guys are just, their emotional lives are really more fixated on problem solving than on anything else, right? And their emotional life is instead racked with fear, it's uncertainty, it's a lot of confusion, just don't even know what it means to open up about how I'm feeling. Let's try, okay. Let's think about this verse right here. Romans 12:15, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. This is a really important verse about calling us. It's an imperative for us to share our emotions with people, to have an open emotional life. But I think a lot of guys look at this, and this is actually how they read it. They say, try really hard to be joyful around people who feel joyful, and try even harder to be weepy with those who weep, you know? And it's just, they're like, I don't even know how to do that. And this, I think this is the read that a lot of guys get on this. But the point is, it's about expressing emotion, not just feeling emotion. A lot of guys probably aren't going to feel high-intensity emotions all the time. That's okay. You know, you're probably not going to cry at movies, and that's not the point. It's expressing emotion. Expressing emotion is an expression of truth. It's not just an expression of a feeling. It's not just associating words with how you feel. It's expressing truth and making a choice to say something and to move into someone's life. That's what this verse is really about, not just feeling things all the time. Let's try an experiment. If you're a girl, this will probably be really easy for you, and we're going to find out why. But if you're a guy, you should give this a shot, okay? So think of the last time you were going through something difficult. So I wouldn't go overboard here. Maybe something was going wrong at work, you know, you had a test coming up, you're stressed out. Try to think of some time like that. How did that make you feel? Now, you can't use any of these words to describe how you felt. You can't say angry, confused, frustrated, upset, bothered, sad, or bummed. And you can't say stressed out either, because I implied that when I said, you know, you can't use that. Does this kind of remind you of homework? A couple of you guys out there are like, this is stupid. Why are we doing this? Well, here's a reason why. All right, so in boys, brain activity associated with negative emotion is localized primarily in the amygdala, a nucleus with comparatively scant connections to the language areas of the brain. It's an interesting insight. It's different in girls, by the way. So it's not easy for a boy to answer in a genuine and articulate way the question, how would you feel, if he may attempt to produce the answer, but it's a chore. It's hard. I can't put words to that because my brain just doesn't operate that way. So they say a better question for most boys would be, what would you do if? Okay, so let's try our experiment again. So think of the last time you were going through something difficult. Have that time in your mind again. Well, what did you do to get through that? What was most or least helpful? You know, what did you do that was really helpful? Did you do anything that made it worse? Who was most helpful? Did anyone move in there, you know, who really helped you out, who had the right thing to say, who knew what to do? You know, what would you do if it happened again? You know, if you had to do it over again, would you do anything differently? Would you do anything the same? Did you make any adjustments? Why? You don't have to ask these exact questions, but these are much easier to answer for a guy. And it's actually revealing a little bit more about a guy's emotional life when he's thinking about, yeah, I did that. When I did that, it was wrong for me to do that. And I only did it because I was angry that someone said this. It's like you're revealing here that it wasn't just that you were angry, it's that you were hurt, you felt belittled, and you reacted to it with an emotion that's a lot more powerful. So you're helping a guy draw this out. It's actually really similar to this passage right here. The plans in a man's heart are deep waters, but a man of understanding draws them out. This is a really important passage for guys right now. Someone who's going to sit with them, who's going to be patient, who's going to ask them questions, who's going to help them draw out these deep waters, help them express themselves and make an environment where it's safe for me to try to say how I feel, for me to try to say what's going on with me, where I'm not going to be told that that's not cool because I'm supposed to be a man. This is a really interesting point here. This is Zimbardo and Colomb. They were reflecting on this mentoring project that these men did. These older men mentored these two younger guys. Totally secular program. No church involvement, nothing biblical at all. These two guys just met up with these younger guys every week, and they had amazing results. It's results that actually had like ongoing impact on these guys' lives. And they're talking about some of the implications of what they noticed, you know, some of the things that they picked up on. This is one thing that they pointed out. So they said, being loved simply for who they are is the unconditional love that moms usually give. Okay, so that's like you play a bad game or something and mom says, well, I love you anyway. I love you no matter what, you know, and she's comforting and nurturing. And love based on performance and effectively trying to achieve something is typically dad's domain. So mom, you know, is more unconditional. She's more supportive. Dad, you know, sets boundaries. He looks for, you know, effort. He praises based on effort. It's not that dad's love is conditional, but that he's usually dads set boundaries more for children. That's just the way that things kind of happen in family dynamics a lot of the time. But they point out here that in this case, the mentors gave both. The mentors were actually able to walk both sides of the fence in this regard. And it's really similar to what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 about his relationships with the Thessalonians, right? Where he says, you know, we were nurturing as a mother, but we were also admonishing and encouraging as a father. Really similar interplay. And again, this is a secular thing. Imagine how much more we could offer in the body of Christ. You know, imagine how much more there is to give out here when there's a spiritual link between us. We have a basis for real closeness and radical relationships. We have a basis for you know, really bold love given out to another person. Imagine how much bigger the impact could be in that kind of scenario. Turns out we really can walk both sides of the fence if we're willing to invest in another guy's life in a deep, meaningful way. That's what this is all about here. It takes a lot of investment, takes a lot of patience, takes a lot of time, discernment. And what we're helping develop is an emotionally stable rock. Maybe a couple of you guys have been thinking about that while we've been talking about this. Well, aren't men supposed to be like an emotionally stable rock? Isn't that a good thing? They shouldn't be, you know, flying off the handle all the time and everything like that. Yeah, I agree. Being an emotionally stable rock is good. But that comes from being an emotionally healthy man. It comes from being a man who's in touch with how his own emotions and other people's emotions. He's become familiar with what to say, how to discern, what questions to ask, patient enough to restrain the need to problem solve before really getting a sense of the issue first. Yeah, that's a good image. Emotionally stable rock comes from being an emotionally healthy man. What we don't want is an emotionally vacant stone. It's the difference. That's someone who doesn't know what to say. This feels uncomfortable. He's telling me all these things. I don't know what to say, so I'm just going to withdraw. I'm going to shut that down. If I can't solve the problem, I'm just going to shut it down. I'm going to move away. That's emotional vacancy. Or I'm only going to focus on, you know, experiences. I'm not going to introduce any new priorities of deep love there. That's emotional vacancy, and that has no strength in it. That's someone who's out of touch emotionally, who's never opened up, who's not willing to go that far. Also, this isn't just negative emotions. This isn't just vulnerability with things that hurt us, with things that bother us, that make us angry or whatever. Stuff like this is important too. Modeling how to express affection, appreciation, and enthusiasm. Like, yeah, I'm really excited about what God's doing in my life right now. Yeah, let's put some teeth on that. Let's make that meaningful. What is God doing that's so meaningful to you? With that guy over there, I really appreciate my friendship with that guy. Okay, let's go tell him that. Let's go over there and tell that other guy that you really value this friendship. You know, I appreciate what you did. So teaching a guy how just to say thanks, how to show some gratitude. I think also showing a guy how to apologize with humility is another one that we could add to the list. How do you apologize effectively to somebody else if you've wronged them? So these are all arenas for vulnerability as well. So imagine them trying to get these things that say matter to them in isolation. It just brings us back to where we were before, craving and entitlement, endless craving and feeling like someone needs to meet these things for me. I need to figure out a way to control my environment enough so that I get rewarded, so that I feel these things happening. This is really how these desires here are going to get met. You know, their confidence and security that they want is still going to come from their identity in Christ. Doesn't fluctuate, doesn't change. Nothing can take that away from you as a believer in God. And this pursuit of their dreams, pursuit of things that are meaningful to them, is going to come from pursuing the mission of Christ together. When we pursue this call to make disciples of all nations together with people who matter to me, who I care about, whose lives I share mine with, that's where their real dream, where they're going to feel like their dreams are coming true. They're going to see transformation in their lives. And the respect that they want is going to come from close relationships. That's where respect happens, where relationships, where it's not just all about me and what I bring to the table and how valuable I am, but it's this mutual, this shared closeness with people. This idea that I'm needed. You know, when we want to be needed from a worldly standpoint, that's all about what skills I bring to the table, what I bring to the table. You know, being needed in the body of Christ, you're not needed in the sense that you're the answer to people's problems. But if you just decide that you won't go any deeper than what's comfortable, you're going to feel like you don't have anything to contribute. You're going to show up to the people who you interact with the most, and if you make the decision that it's too uncomfortable to be vulnerable, to go any deeper than I feel comfortable with them, to share any more than I'm willing to hear them any more than what makes me comfortable, you're going to feel like I have nothing to contribute. I don't know what else to give here. My skill set has been exhausted. If you won't go there with people, you're going to feel really empty around the people that you're trying to love the most. Got to show guys what it means to go deeper than that, to give more than that. What about this verse that we hit on originally here? Be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong. What does that mean? Really gets revealed in our next verse here. Let all that you do be done in love. All that militaristic language from that previous verse, all those military-like imperatives are all anchored on having love being the driving thing in your life. The decision that I'm going to love people, I'm going to put myself out there. I'm going to engage with the world around me rather than retreat from it. I think this is really the great escape for a lot of guys. It's a refusal to love and a refusal to be loved. A refusal to let anybody in and a refusal to give anything out. It's too scary. It doesn't make enough sense. I don't know how to do it. Are we frustrated with men because of this? Yeah. Yeah, I think we are. I think this does. Well, a lot of us have ended up frustrated with the men in our lives for these reasons. We see them refusing things like this, and we don't understand why. We just don't get why they won't change, why they won't do more, why they won't express themselves more to us. But we got to be more than frustrated. We can't be so frustrated that we back away from them. You know, in one of these mentoring studies, one thing that they notice is that people tend to back away from young guys because they're uncomfortable with the emotional state that these guys are in, and it reminds them of all the difficult times that they ever had, and so they back away from them. There's this tendency to back away from young guys because what they're going through is difficult. If we are frustrated and we're backing away from men when they need us to move in there, that's just not good enough. That's not giving them the type of alternatives that the Lord wants them to know is available to them, that they can move into their life, that they can pursue an active role in loving people rather than endlessly craving, never having that sense of entitlement ever met, and just sitting back and feeling like I've got nothing really to contribute. We have to win them out of that, weaponize them so that they can move in strong where the areas where God's calling them, and model what that looks like. The question we need to ask is, do we believe in the men in our lives? Do we believe that they can be more than that? Do we believe there's something out there for them to achieve and for them to do? You know, do we believe that God wants to use these men? He wants to transform their lives. And do we believe that we can be a huge part of that process if we go beyond our frustrations and actually invest in them in the hardcore way the Bible calls us to?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.